Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. As I mentioned in the previous episode, this episode starts with some topics, or some packages, rather, not topics. Topics or packages. The packages that I can't really talk too much about, because it's just not useful to go over each one of these. These are the XF86 input collections, and these are drivers for, in the input, in the case of the input, input and video, they're drivers. There, said it. XFS input dash something is a driver for some kind of device, like a joystick, or a keyboard, or for libinput, or for a mouse, or for a VM mouse, for a Wacom, and so on. The one I do want to talk about a little bit is Synaptics, because Synaptics, at least for a while, Synaptics was kind of like a go-to driver for a lot of people, because this was at a time when touchpads were, I don't think they were like new, but they were starting to become a lot more complex. Touchpads at one point were just kind of like, you know, you put your finger on the touchpad, and where your finger goes, your cursor goes. That was a touchpad. But then people started using fancier inputs so that, you know, if you had two fingers on the touchpad, it was like you were scrolling, like you were controlling a scroll wheel. If you had three on the touchpad, then it was like you were swiping, and if you swiped horizontally, then you got a different result, you know, and so lots of different sort of ways of detecting input through this single, simple, flat surface. And Synaptics is the touchpad, it's like the big touchpad driver for Linux. And there were often little adjustments you could make to how Linux was treating or interpreting your touchpad actions in case, like, maybe you had a touchpad that was capable of things that Linux didn't expect you to be capable of, or you wanted it to behave a little bit differently. A good example would be like a laptop. Well, I mean, certainly it would be a laptop with a touchpad, but some touchpads kind of come out of the, or sort of by default, I guess, the expectation is, for whatever reason, that that you can tap the touchpad to click. It's a feature that I cannot stand, but it is a feature that some people like. I always feel like something like that. I mean, you're always tapping a touchpad, right? You're tapping it to put your finger onto it in the first place. It's supposed to differentiate between like a press and release, as it were, and now my finger is on the touchpad. But I don't know. I always felt like it was not capable of differentiating that all the time. But there's the Synaptics driver was able to, you had some adjustments that you could do. And so you could use the SYN client to pass arguments to, or, you know, keys and values to Synaptics to modify, to change the settings for how your touchpad would be treated. So you could turn off, for instance, tapping tap to click. Now, nowadays, I don't even see Synaptics or SYN client really being installed on a lot of distributions by default. They just expect you to, and I think this is pretty reasonable, just to configure that in your system settings. So it's, once again, like, great command to know about, but quite possibly you have access to it through a system setting or something. Now, that assumes you have that system setting installed. I mean, literally the package of system settings installed, because if you're using like Fluxbox or TWM, or maybe even, I was going to say XFCE, but actually they have a pretty good control panel. But yeah, I mean, I guess I could imagine using Fluxbox with the XFCE panel, for instance. So in other words, maybe you don't have a control panel or a system settings to provide access to setting a driver, in which case you could install SYN client and then configure it. Now, the computer that I have Synaptics on right now is my Slackware box, and it's not a laptop. The laptop that I do have on hand is a Fedora laptop, and as I've said, they don't actually even bother with SyncClient because they've got GNOME settings, and so they don't bother. So I can't remember all of the things in SyncClient, but as I recall, you just type in SyncClient dash probably dash A. SyncClient. I mean, I can't because it tells me, well, there you don't have any SyncClient settings. No, it's dash L to list all your current settings. And then you can add new settings through, I think, SynDaemon, maybe? SynDaemon disabling the touchpad while typing avoids unwanted movement. Oh, that's SynDaemon. Okay. Yeah, and that was a good one, too. SynDaemon I did use a lot as well because sometimes you'd put your hands on your keyboard and your, you'd brush against the touchpad and it would think it was, input. So I did have SynDaemon activate, or rather I should say deactivate the touchpad when I started typing, that kind of thing. So that was useful at one point. I think touchpad technology on both ends, the hardware and the software, has come a long way. And I haven't used SynClient or SynDaemon or, you know, directly Synaptix myself. I mean, Synaptix I'm probably using, but I mean, not directly. But they are definitely really, really valuable options to know about in case you're not using a desktop with settings that talk to Synaptix. You can talk to Synaptix yourself with SynClient and SynDaemon. Okay, the next package set. So that's like 10 packages right there that I'm just skipping over blissfully. Next up is XF86 Video, and these are all the different drivers for video chips. So you've got common ones like AMD GPU. That's not really the most. Oh, there's ATI. Remember ATI? There's Cirrus. I don't know what that is. I128. That's familiar, but I don't know what it is. Intel. That's familiar. And eventually here it is. Nouveau and NV and Open Chrome and R128. I think that's, what is that? Rage 128 or something? I'm not sure. Video rendition. Yeah. So there's a bunch of drivers here. Wow. A bunch of drivers. I mean, a lot of drivers for different video devices, which obviously are really important because you do want access to graphic processors, but it's also got things like V4L, which is Video for Linux, which is the thing that drives a lot of webcams. So if you're using a webcam on Linux, quite likely you're using V4L. So that's awfully handy to have. And then the emergency must have VESA. That's like the really, really basic, like, let's just get an image on the screen. I don't think there's any Linux user who's been with Linux for more than, let's say at the time of recording, 15 years? I don't know. Some number of years, 10 or 12 years, who hasn't, maybe longer than that. I don't know. Early on in Linux, like the goal frequently was just to get an image on your screen. You didn't care how it got there. You didn't care whether it was pretty. You just needed an image just to tell yourself, to convince yourself that there was hope. And the way that you could do that sometimes is by invoking the privilege of VESA, of VESA. If you could get VESA, just the fallback, like, just talk to my monitor driver, then you could see an image. It was very frequently 800 by 600 pixels. So really bad. I mean, like, no desktop could fit on that screen. It was just so bad. No, there was no window that was designed for an 800 by 600 screen. But at least you knew that you are dealing with hardware that works. I mean, like, that sometimes was just enough to keep you going for another week while you struggled to get the settings right so that you could get like a full, you know, 1280 by 768 display on your, you know, AMD chip or your NVIDIA chip. Eventually, I feel like the Intel chips, what were they, like 928s or something? Or am I making that up? 950s? I don't know. Intel, some magical Intel number came along. And I feel like that was kind of a turning point. At least that's my feeling. And I could be wrong, but that for me at least, that was a big turning point because I just felt like when you put Linux on something with Intel, you just didn't have to think too much about it. It was really quite nice. And this is not an ad for Intel. I don't use Intel much. I mean, like, I think Do I have an, is this laptop Intel? The laptop might be Intel, but I mean, I buy AMD all the time, but at the time, like, it was really, really refreshing to be able to just say, okay, this is the configuration. In fact, there was even a name for it. I think it was, I don't remember the name. There was a set of components by Intel that you just kind of, it was sort of a guarantee that it was going to work with Linux. I mean, yeah, there might be something else, like the webcam might not work because that's not by Intel. But like in terms of getting Linux running on your machine, like you could just buy, it was the same configuration as in the Sony VAIOs. V-A-I-O is an old Sony laptop that doesn't exist anymore, as in the MacBooks at the time, and a lot of other just computers. They just bought this one sort of plug-and-play thing from Intel, and boy, was it plug-and-play for Intel, for Linux, as it turned out. So that was really great. Okay, so that's all I have to say. In fact, probably more than I really had to say about XF86 video drivers. The next one up is XF86 DGA. This is a test client, test client for XF86 DGA, which is direct something or another, I think. Man XF86 DGA. I'm pretty sure it just tells you that it's a client library for X86 DGA. So if you don't know what XDGA is or DGA is, then you don't need to know. That's the message that they have sent, in my view. So the command that it ships with is DGA. You need to be root for this. So I'm going to do sudo DGA and type in my password. And then I get an X error of failed request XF86 DGA. No direct video mode. Major opcode of failed request is 153. The minor opcode is 1. The serial number is 15. And the current serial number is 15. So there you go. That's a fail. Don't know what DGA is. Apparently don't need to know according to the documentation. XFD is next after XF86 DGA. XFD displays all characters in a font using either the X11 core protocol or libxft2. Well, if it's fonts in X, you can bet it's not going to work for me. And is that true? Let's find out. XFD, let's do a dash dash help first, says that I just need to pass the, well, options, those are optional, and then dash FN font or dash FA font. What's the difference between FN font and FA font? Well, FN, according to the man page, is an option specifying the Core X server-side font to be displayed. FA specifies the XFT font to be displayed. So this is an XFT font that we're going to be attempting to display. XFD-FA, and then I need a font. Oh, shoot. Okay, let's back up. Let's do a cat of user share fonts, 100 DPI, sounds good. And, ooh, boy, there are a lot more than I realized, like hundreds, like several hundred font files here. Okay, let's just take this one at random. Core B10-ISO8859-10.pcf.gz, and we will cat that to my temporary directory as just core B10.pcf.gz. And then I'm going to do a gunzip of core. Okay, now I've got core B10.pcf. So now if I do XFD-FA core B10.pcf, hit return, it worked. I actually got what was advertised in lots of different ways. This is amazing. So this is a graphical application written in XFT, and it is displaying the name of the font, which is Liberation Sans 12. So, I mean, why wouldn't it be named CORB10? Like, that makes sense, right? Liberation Sans, and it's 12, and it's called Core B10. C-O-U-R, like courier, except not. Okay, anyway, style regular, and a bunch of boxes that I've called, that I've since learned are called tofu. So they're just empty white boxes. And then there's two rows of those. But then it starts in earnest with actual characters, like an exclamation mark and a quotation mark and a hash and a dollar sign and a percent and ampersand. And then all the digits, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, oh, and 0 there. A and all the alphabets and then some more tofu and then some special symbols and some accents. And I could say what? Plus 16, what does that mean? Oh, so advance by 16. Yeah, so that's kind of a scroll function. Lots of tofu here. Previous, or quit. So yeah, if you want to see a font, like a .pcf font, xfd-fa, not -fn, that'll try to contact a font server, which I can't figure out how to get working. So if you want to try to do that, then you could certainly, you're welcome. And let me know if you get one running. F-A for a local font, and then point it at certainly a .pcf file, I can confirm does indeed work. Can we replicate further font success? Maybe. X-Font Cell, that's the next one. It's a X11 font selector. And this is a very charming little application. This is it's a bit of a font book, a font manager in a way. It's not really a font manager. It is a font book, though. So if you just launch it, X-Font Cell, no arguments. It opens up a little funky XFT type window, and along the top, it's a little bit difficult to identify, but along the top there's a menu, and it doesn't look like a menu. It looks like just garbage. I mean, it looks like an error to me, honestly, because it's just fndry-fmly-wght-slant-swdth-adsty-pxls-z-ptsz-resx-resy. So you might be picking up, if you look at it again, you realize, oh wait, these are words. There's foundry, family, weight, slant, width, or I should say S-width. I don't know what that means. Slant width, maybe. A-D-S-T-Y-L, maybe style. P-X-L-S-Z, maybe pixel size. P-T-S-Z, maybe point size or something. Res X, resolution X. Res Y, resolution Y. S-P-C, space, and so on. And that's just in a big row across the top. So it really does. It looks like an error message or like something that couldn't render correctly. But actually, these are menus. And in proper X fashion, if you click and release, the menu just flashes on and goes away. So you have to click and hold. And then you see that there's a list of a bunch of foundries. There's Adobe, Arabic, B and H. Is that B and H? Like, the photo store in New York, Bitstream, Chronix, Daewoo, DEC, DEC, IBM, Microsoft, Mutt, Monotype, and so on. So I'm going to take Bitstream as the foundry, and there it is. There's some Bitstream on the screen. It's tiny. There's no way to increase the size or anything like that I can tell. Although there was that one. Where was that family, first of all? Okay, we'll go Bitstream. Well, here's Courier 10 Pitch. So let's use that. Slant is currently, it seems to be on. R maybe for, oh yeah, R for regular. Okay, I'll take that. Thanks. And then I thought there was a size or something. There's no size here. Family weight. Weight? That's like bold. Width? No. Normal? Yeah. I don't know. I don't know where the... Oh, point size maybe? 120? No. Pixel size? 17? No. Okay. Yeah, I don't know how to get this thing to be a different size. I mean, there's a bunch of menus here, as you've already heard, and I didn't even read all of them. So anyway, yeah, that's a mystery. But you do get to see the font. That's the cool thing. And you get to kind of browse your fonts. So you don't have to know the font that you want. You can just kind of look through the different selections. And I don't really know how to I don't know how to get out of my current selection. I don't know. I can't unselect. Now that I've selected this font, I'm trapped, apparently. So I can quit that application and relaunch to look at a different font family or font foundry. Sorry, it's Microsoft family. But a lot of them are blanked out. Where is it getting this list? This is so bizarre. I don't understand. I don't understand where it's getting these things from. Like, okay, so if I go to Adobe, for instance, which I would never do, but I did. Family, there's a huge list. Like the menu of family comes up and takes up the entire screen practically, and only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 are actually highlightable, selectable. All the other ones are grayed out. And bizarrely, like some of them don't even, I mean, like, Here's one in the Adobe Foundry, Noto Serif CJK JP. Well, we know that's not Adobe. That's Google. The site is right. You know, like you can go to the Noto site and look at that. That's not an Adobe font. So I don't know where X Font Cell is getting its information, but it's obviously seeing a lot more than is relevant, and then it's misinterpreting what it does see. So I don't know. I mean, once again, very old school kind of X11 application. You're probably not going to use it. I mean, and I feel that's, I can say that pretty confidently. You're not going to use that application. I can see how people would have found it useful at one point. I do like the idea for X11 20 years ago that they had a font selector. I think that's great. Very progressive idea, actually exposing something to the user so that they can make a choice for themselves and not just have to guess at what exists. That's great. That's really good stuff. But I don't think it's something that you're going to use today. I still think that we need better font management today. Like, I understand, you know, font installation on Plasma desktop, really super easy. Love it. It's very exciting. But I still think that there needs to be a way where we can turn fonts on and off really easily, or search through fonts by attribute better. I don't love how fonts are managed today even. So this was a step in the, you know, in the modern direction, and you can see how we've iterated on this idea of a font selector. I'm glad that we have, because that's not a great application, but it is very cool to see. Like, as a snapshot in time, very cool. Next application, next package, we'll have to wait until after coffee, and so will you, and so will I. Let's go get coffee. Okay, I'm back. I'm still working on my big cozy coffee. I don't have B2 open yet, but soon, very, very soon. And this is still great. I mean, it's still really good coffee. You really just can't go wrong with flight coffee. That is just, they're not all great, but there are several really good ones there. Let's talk about XFD. No, we already talked about that. Let's talk about XFS. That's what I meant to say. So in a previous episode, I had spent the better part of a week trying to get XFS to work, and I just could not seem to get it working. I couldn't figure out why. I mean, it was running. XFS. That's the font server. That's the X11 font server. Something that I don't believe anyone even uses, but it is. It's there. It exists. It comes with X11, so I wanted to try to get it to work. Could not get it to work. Rather, I could get it to, I started XFS. It appeared to be running. It created a log file with not very useful information in it. The documentation was not very useful, so I couldn't figure out what was wrong. Well, it turns out that, as I've said about the X11 documentation, the dots are not connected here. You have to figure this out, for better or for worse. Mostly for worse. But by chance, in this episode, when I was working to get this episode researched, I still couldn't get XFS to work, and I spent way too long on it again. Furious. Just absolutely just blood boiling, right? So then I finally get to the end of the list of packages for today's episode, and I happen upon Xhost, and I'm thinking, yeah, I've heard of Xhost. It's like some kind of weird old authentication application that people used to, or non-authentication system, basically. People used to use it so that they could connect to another computer on the network really easily, and it's not really in use anymore because it doesn't really have strong encryption, or might not even have encryption at all. It's just something, it's an archaic old system. But I mean, you know what? Why not? Let's try to get it to work, whatever it does. Like, again, documentation's horrible. So it's just like, I don't mean all documentation is horrible. The documentation for X11 is horrible. So it's just, Xhost. It exists. It does this thing. Okay, well, great. What do I use with Xhost? It doesn't say. I think it's XDM, but then I'd have to have a computer running XDM. Whatever. All right, so lots of confusion, lots of bumbling around. But you know what? I got a virtual machine. Let's give this a go. So I fiddle around with Xhost for a while, and eventually I get to the point where I've got that up and running. Like, Xhost is, like, working. Like, it's doing the thing that it's, you know, it's configured correctly. I mean, it's one line. And then I realize that because I've got Xhost running, I've added a user to this system. What if I then launched an XFont server and tried to connect to XFont server? And that was what it was. So the XFont server was working the whole time. It's just that Xhost hadn't granted the correct permissions so that you could then connect to the XFont server. So again, kind of like a firewall, you have to, which I was an analogy I was using for something completely different in a couple of episodes back about the XDG desktop portal. But you kind of have to, you have to list what you want to let in. Now, this is very confusing, and I don't know that it's working correctly, really, because the man page just doesn't match up with what counts as success for me. But so the man page says for Xhost. So I'm skipping down to Xhost, and then I'll skip back up to XFS and circle around to XFS info as well, packages. So Xhost, the idea is that you can add an exception to the block list. Everything's blocked. You can poke holes. So Xhost plus, that's opening a permission, plus, and then some family name. And there are six or seven families. There's INET for an internet host IPv4. There's INET6 for an internet host IPv6. There's DNET for a DECnet host, NIS for, you know, RPC network, KRB for Kerberos, that seems progressive, local, that contains only one name, the empty string, and then SI, server interpreted. By the way, what does that mean? Contains only one name, comma, the empty string. That doesn't make any sense. Who wrote that? Anyway, SI, server interpreted. What does that mean? Well, luckily it does tell you what server interpreted sort of means. It says server interpreted addresses consist of a case-sensitive type tag and a string representing a given value separated by a colon. For example, SI colon hostname, colma almas, is a server interpreted address of type hostname with the value of almas. For more information on the available forms of server interpreted addresses, see X Security, which is a man page. So if you go to man page X Security, there's a bunch of information about sort of the way that it does authorize and server interpreted access types, which eventually you'll get down to just IPv6. Host name, local user, and local group. And for host name, it just says the value must be a host name as defined in IETF RFC 2396. Due to mobile IP and dynamic DNS, the name service is consulted at connection, and so on. Okay, so there's a lot to process there, and it can seem a little bit overwhelming, but let's just give it a go, right? So Xhost plus INET, so this is going to be IPv4, colon, and then we're supposed to just say, I think, just, because that's not a host name. So how can we get the IP? Well, apparently just IPv6 or a host name. So there is no option for an IPv4 IP, as far as I can tell, which seems like a glaring omission, so much so that it feels like maybe that's not true. And yet, it's not listed here. It's IPv6, hostname, local user, and local group. So that doesn't seem like it's going to necessarily work. I could put a hostname in, but I don't think I have the infrastructure for that to work right now. Not on this local, not on this, this virtual machine. So that's not going to work. Bizarrely, what eventually did work was xhost. By the way, to reset xhost is just xhost space dash or minus. That closes everything back off. What did work in the end, bizarrely, was xhost space plus si, so that's the server interpreted, colon local user colon bogus. Bogus being the main user on this system, on this virtual machine. So to me, that means that the local user of bogus is now added to the exceptions list. Bogus is allowed to access this this system now. But I don't have bogus on any other computer. It's just a virtual machine user. It's not like a real, it's not a real thing. So how does that make any sense? Well, I don't know. So now let's try XFS in, actually, you know what? I'm going to open that up in a separate terminal just in case. On my virtual machine, XFS takes over the terminal because I didn't demonize it. That's fine. It's in a different tab. And now I'm going to switch back over to my workstation and use the XFS info command. That's a separate package, XFinfo. It gets XFS info. It gives you information about the font server. The syntax for this, it shouldn't be surprising at this point, is a little bit quirky. XFS info dash server. TCP, I think it's a backslash? Or forward slash, whatever, 192.168.122.82:7100 is what I'm giving it. And it comes back lickety-split with information about the XFS, the font server. It tells me that the server is located at TCP/192.168.122.82:7100, version 2, vendor string is Xorg Foundation, release number is 10200,000, the XFS version is 1.20, maximum request size is 8192 words, that is 32,768 bytes. Number of catalogs is 1 all. Number of alternate servers is 0. Number of extensions is 0. And there you go. A font server is running on my virtual machine, and it's accessible by XFS info on a different machine, but apparently only because I've given it this weird server interpreted permission, which it doesn't, there's no bogus user being involved here, so that doesn't feel like it makes sense. So now that XFS is running, I'm going to go back and do xhost minus to reset everything, and I'm going to try this fancy IPv4 thing again. So xhost plus inet colon 192.168.122.1. That's the IP address, that's the virtual interface through which my host gets into the virtual machine. So the traffic should appear like it's, you know, that it's coming from there. Okay, XFS info on my workstation, and okay, it's still working. That was a little bit unexpected. Okay, so now I'm starting to suspect that it isn't what's after the plus. It is the plus. Almost like, yeah, I feel like that plus, well, it doesn't say that though. So it says access control disabled, clients can connect from any host. And sure enough, if I do an XFS info from my host now, from my workstation, obviously I get the same information. So I don't know. I feel like what's possibly potentially happening is that xhost is just opening up more permissions than it claims to be using. Well, you know, and now, funny enough, now I can't get the thing not to work because I just typed in xhost minus XFS info and it's returning data. So now it doesn't even seem like xhost is involved in any way, even though that's the thing that made all of this work in the first place. So either xhost minus is not doing what it says it's doing, or xhost plus isn't doing what it's saying it's doing, or something else has happened that I'm not picking up on. But look, the end result is that I ran an X11 font server, and I was able to query it to some degree with XFS info. That's something, right? That's a thing. I don't know exactly what it is. I know that there was like the font show. No, show font. Show font dash H for help. Let's say show font dash server. This is from a couple of episodes ago, obviously. Show font dash server TCP blah, 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 blah. Return, no, because now I need a font name. Liberation. Liberation Sans, Liberation Space Sans with quotes. Oh, dash FN, font name. Liberation. There we go. No. FS error, bad name, named font does not exist. Liberation Sans? Doesn't exist. Courier? Doesn't exist. Times? Doesn't exist. I don't know what it wants from me. Oh, well. Obviously, there's a whole system here of fonts and font serving and getting information from font servers. And as fascinating as it is, it's a whole other thing. Like it's a whole other podcast, I think, really. I do feel like I'm on the cusp though. Like I think there are other utilities that would give me the font name if I point it at the font that I want to look at. And then I could maybe be passing the correct font name to the thing. So yeah, I think there's a way to get all of this working. It's just functionally, it's not very useful because I'm not using that many X applications that would even know what to do with a font server. But there you go. That's XFS, XFS Info, and XHost all in one go. Not sure how related any of them are to one another. XGamma is next up, and it allows you to query and alter, supposedly, your gamma correction or gamma value of your screen. So just typing in XGamma is safe. It tells you what your current gamma values are, which I think probably typically it's going to, unless you've changed it, it's red 1, green 1, blue one. So you can set that, you can change those values a couple of different ways. You can change all of them with X gamma dash gamma and then the value that you want it to be. So 0 is completely off. I don't recommend it. 1.0 would be all on. And that's a unilateral equal shift. So it'll take red, green, and blue and just dial down dial down or up, I guess. The gamma value. But you could also target just one luma range. So you could say, let's do just the red gamma. So that would be dash R gamma and then some number. Or the green G gamma. Or the blue B gamma. It actually is pretty intuitive. And again, the all on is 1.0, all off is 0.0. Don't recommend that one. But you could do, for instance, it's pretty safe to do something like X gamma dash gamma 0.7. Yeah, let's do 0.7. That should be noticeable. Yep, that is noticeable. I'll even go down to 0.3. Ooh, that's really dark. Not good. And then I'll go back up to 1.0. That's better. So yeah, you have control over your gamma settings right here from your terminal. That's kind of cool. Do you need it? I don't know. I mean, how often do you need to do that? Maybe often. I don't know. Like at night, maybe your screen's too bright. That's one way of adjusting that, really. So, I mean, backlight should also work. But on my computer, at least, it wasn't working. So X gamma, that it worked, actually quite surprised me. There is XGC, which is a demo client that shows off various features of X11. This is a GUI application with buttons and windows or little panes, and you can do silly things. So, for instance, you can do a... You draw, basically. You draw programmatically, and it's pretty fascinating. So there's various functions. I just used the defaults, but I'm going to actually run a different one now. Clear window. Okay. So there's a couple of different functions. There's clear and reverse copy and inverted, no op, XOR, or nor, equiv, invert, or reverse, and so on. Goes on like that. So let's do an invert instead. Line style, you can do solid, on off dash, or double dash. I'm gonna just leave it on solid. Cap style, not last, round, but, projecting. Join style mitre round bevel. Let's do round. Fill style solid, tiled, stippled, or opaque stippled. I'll just leave it on solid. Fill rule, even odd, or winding. Arc mode is chord or pie slice. Plain mask. You can mask out something. Don't know what that is. Dash list. That's how the dashes appear. I'm not using dashes, so I don't think it'll matter. Line width is currently set to 0. That seems small. Let's set it to 1. Font is some random array of probably hex. Foreground is 0. Background is nothing I recognize as a hex value. It's 42944967295. Don't know what that is. And then percentage of test is 100. And then the test, you have lots to choose from. Copy area, points, segments, arcs, filled rectangle, put image, text 0 and 16, rectangles, lines, copy plane, and so on. I guess I'll do arcs. Why not? And then I'm going to run. Oh, that's so cool. I just made like a tunnel, a weird looking tunnel. That's really cool. Let's try and inverted. Oh, that doesn't do anything. Equiv? Okay, that's cool too. Yeah, so there's, it's weird. It's a weird application. I mean, it is a demo application. So oh, that is so cool. I just changed it to tiled and got something completely different. So yeah, it's a weird application, but it is, as I say, a demo application. It's meant to show you what you can do essentially on a canvas. Like, these are the draw functions you have available to you within this widget set. If you're drawing things, here's how that might look. Here's the performance. And then if you look at the source code, obviously now you kind of know how to do that yourself. So that's, again, useful. Sample applications are really useful. Xhost is technically the next package, but I just talked about Xhost rather at length, I guess. I really feel, once again, the X11 documentation's rubbish. It isn't telling a full story. It's telling you what each component does, and it's not telling you how to get from one place to another. And by X11 documentation, I mean the man pages. I'm sure there's a lot more information I could look up online about all of this, although the information I've been able to find has been very, very much targeted to developers about how to develop for X11, not a whole lot about the sysadmin trying to set up a cohesive system. So I'm just not convinced that this is well put together, or at least well explained, and that's just how I feel. Xinit is the next package. Xinit is the thing that controls what happens when you start or when you initialize X. That's important because when you start X, you have now started a graphical environment over the top of your computer. Like, all the text and stuff, it's hidden. Now you've got a desktop in front of you. But which desktop? And that's what Xinit, that's one of the things that Xinit is primarily concerned with. Like, what do you want X to do once you start X? Now, ideally on your system, whether or not you've set anything in Xinit, it would at the very least start TWM or something like that. But you have a lot of options. I mean, one of the easy options is to use XWM config, a nice little shell script by Patrick Folkerding, which we talked about in X11-utils, I think it was. No, X11-skel, S-K-E-L. So you can use that to set up your Xinit file without really even thinking about it. All the details get taken care of by Patrick Volkerding, which is great. I mean, that's a great reason to use Slackware, because it's just got all that stuff kind of already figured out for you. But there's other things you could do in your Xinit file. So .xinitrc is the file, the configuration file that Xinit calls. Xinit, you're not usually calling yourself. You're not manually calling Xinit. You're usually using a better command like start X. But that invokes Xinit, and Xinit parses .xinitrc to figure out what you want to do when X is starting. It's easy enough to see an example of this. They live in /etc/x11/xinit, and then there are a bunch of files there, which you'll probably recognize from xwmconfig if you've used that. xinitrc Well, and if you've installed Slackware, you've at least seen XWM config because it happens during the install, as well as, you know, you can launch it manually, but it happens there at the end. So xinitrc.kde, for instance, has some settings like user resources equals $home/.xresources, user mod map, $home/.xmodmap, sys/etc/x11/xinit/xresources, sysmodmap, you get the idea. It goes through a couple of checks, and then finally it starts the window manager if -z desktop session -a-x user bin ck launch session, then ck launch session dbus launch -sh -syntax -exit with session start plasma -x11 else dbus launch with exit with session start plasma -x11. That's the script you're using, or something like that. That's what you're using when you log into your Slackware box. That's the kind of settings and the checks that happen with the xinit process. And it is literally xinit. Like, if you look at user bin start x, you'll see eventually somewhere towards the bottom, probably, there is an xinit command. And it is, it's reading from your /etc/xinit/x11/xinit. I can't find this stupid thing, but it's there. Trust me. Xinit. There we go. Yeah. Xinit client args -server display server args. I don't know what any of those values are, but I bet they have something to do with where xinitrc is. So, it is literally xinit happening. It is parsing your xinitrc file and it's doing some things, but traditionally, like, it could have been even sort of weirder. So, for instance, one of the examples in the xinit man page is that you might want to start, you load the resources, just like in Pat's script, xrdb-load home/.xresources, xsetroot-solidgray, so you're setting the background, xclock-g, the geometry, 50, x50 -0 -+0, so it's putting one of those xclocks in the corner, xload, I don't know what that is, xterm, geometry in one place, another xterm for some reason, not sure why they're launching two, maybe one on either side or something, yeah, and then twm. So in the xinit system, there, you know, this pretend user, this sample user, is basically building the desktop. They're starting some, they're auto launching some utility type programs like xclock and xterm, and they're setting a background, and then they're launching twm, and that's what happens when they type in start x or however they get there, you know, pass through the xdm login process. So xinit today typically just kind of points in the direction of a desktop environment. But traditionally, at one point, it was more like the configuration file you might build for like Fluxbox or OpenBox or even TWM or FVWM, where you're really, you know, you kind of have these configuration files and you're launching the little applications that you want to serve as kind of those always on utility applications, and maybe a couple of applications that you just know you're going to launch anyway. I used to do that on Fluxbox all the time. I would have my login set so that when Fluxbox launched, it also launched a terminal window and maybe a music player, you know, whatever else I wanted, because I knew that I was going to get there anyway, so I might as well have it open. Next package is xisxwayland. This is a theoretically cool little application. I mean, it's very, very pointed. It does exactly one thing, and that is it tells you whether your x session is an xwayland session. So xisxwayland, return nothing. Well, in Unix, silence means success. So, and the question was, is it xwayland? So I'm guessing that means yes, x is wayland. No response, yes, because some response would have been no. Let's follow up on that theory. X is xwayland-h. Okay, this says that it's got one option, which is --verbose. And there's an exit status list here. 0 is the X server is Wayland. Okay, so I guess by zero they mean, like, probably nothing, right? One is the X server is not X Wayland. Two is invalid usage. Three is failed to connect to the X server. Okay, so that means that when I issue the command X is X Wayland and I get nothing back, then that counts as zero, I guess. So I am running X Wayland. But wait a minute, I'm not running X Wayland. I happen to know that. So what's up? So --- verbose. X is X Wayland --- verbose. X Wayland colon no, capital N-O. Okay, so what's going on? Because X is X Wayland didn't send me anything, and now verbose tells me no. So those are two conflicting things. Okay, so X is X Wayland, and then we'll redirect. So we'll go to redirect ampersand 1. So we're redirecting standard error to standard out. Still nothing. What if I don't know, pipe it to T? Still nothing. So there's just, I don't know. I don't understand the output here. I really don't. So what if we, against all hope, let's do a T-A to my temporary directory, and we'll call it what Wayland, and then cat temporary directory what Wayland. It's just empty. So I don't know, X is X Wayland is not returning a value to me by default, but it does give me information if I say to be verbose about it. I guess I could also do this, X is X Wayland. Okay, so that's going to send some kind of signal, right? So I could say ampersand ampersand, so that's positive positive echo yes. So if I get a zero, I should see an echo of yes, and I did not. So now I'm gonna do pipe pipe instead. So X is X Wayland pipe pipe echo no, and then I get a no. Okay, there we go. There's something. But boy, was that not clear. That's really not clear. Well, I guess it is though, because it says exit code. But then how do you exit? How do you detect the exit code of like 2 and 3? I wonder. I've just never seen anything that's resolutely not send anything to standard error. That's pretty surprising. So yeah, X is X Wayland. If you're not sure, check. X is X Wayland. I guess. Probably pipe pipe echo no. I mean, you know, some or whatever, like whatever you want to do upon no, or maybe ampersand if yes. I don't know. It just depends on your use case, I guess. But yeah, I feel like that took a little bit longer than it should have to figure out. But I get it now. It just took me a little while to get the logic, I guess. Okay, and finally for this episode, XKB, a couple of different XKB ones. XKB comp, XKB EVD, XKB print, and XKB utils. These are all keyboard related packages. Most of them have like just one or maybe two utilities in them. The XKB comp is a essentially a compiler of keyboard descriptions. And these keyboard descriptions come in XKM, or rather that's a compiled file. So they come in a variety of different descriptors, which you can see, of course, we've seen these already in other packages that describe the layout and the variant and so on. That gets compiled together into a .xkm file. I don't know, that's a key map. XKM is a compiled key map file. The problem is, I guess, is that I don't know where those key map files actually get stored, because I don't seem to have them on my system. I don't know where they are. I cannot find even a single .xkm file. I've looked in Etsy, I've looked in USR, I've looked in my home directory, just can't find them. I don't understand what they're for exactly. And I think maybe they must be either, I don't imagine they would be temporary files. But yeah, I guess they must not be very much in use, because I cannot find one, which surprised me. I thought, okay, well, I'll go look at a .xkm file. And I just couldn't find a single one. So that was weird. XKB comp. XKB EVD is a self-identified incomplete application. It is not meant as a complete application, apparently. It is an example to developers. It is a little bit like XEV, whatever. I don't know why it exists, because it does seem to be, to my mind, inferior to XEV. Xeve, whatever. Because I mean, I've raved about Xeve there, said it, in previous, you know, when we talked about the package. It launches a little window. You put your cursor there, you press keys, and you see exactly all the data about the key, whether it was a key press or a key release, what key code it produced, and so on. This other one, XKBEVD, kind of, well, it doesn't do that. It doesn't open a window. It just takes over your terminal, and it detects your clicks. And that's all I could get it to do, is detect clicks. If you type, you just see your typing there in the terminal, and it affects nothing, and no data, you get no data on it. So I don't understand why that application exists compared to XEV. I would think that would be the more useful application. Maybe not. Maybe there's a bunch of GUIcraft in there that they didn't want to put. So EVD is a good little demonstration of just getting the events. That could be, but it is. I mean, in the man page, it says it's not complete. It's a sample application. Next up is XKB print. This sounds like a really fun one. And this is the reason I was looking for XKM files, because it can render a PDF version or a PostScript or EPS, whatever, encapsulated PostScript, file of a key map based on the description given in an XKM file. What a great little tool. And I think, I mean, we've seen this before. You may have seen, I don't remember what application it is, but there is like a virtual sort of keyboard map that you can see. I think it's actually in system settings when you're selecting your keyboard. It'll show you like, okay, this is what we think you've got. I could be making that up, but it's a great idea. It's just, for whatever reason, as I've said, don't have any XKM files on my system. So that's XKB print. I think that sounds really cool, but you do need an XKM file to produce an EPS. And an EPS you could open in like Inkscape, or you could even convert, I think, with what would do the conversion? PDF? No, FOP. I think FOP would do it. I could be wrong about that. Maybe it's just Inkscape. So either way, that sounds like a cool trick if you have the right source files. And then finally, last one for the episode, XKB utils. This one has a couple of different little utilities, as the name suggests in it. There's XKB Bell, XKB VLEDs, and XKB Watch. XKB VLEDs is a fun one. It's really fascinating. Don't know why it's really, why it exists exactly, but it shows you an array of little, you know, graphical LED lights. And if you have LED lights on your keyboard, like to indicate when the caps lock is on, for instance, which I don't have because I don't have a caps key, but a number lock, for instance, num lock. So if I press that on my keyboard, it lights up or stops lighting up on my little window. So it reflects accurately the state of an LED on your keyboard. There's a bunch of them here, and I can't quite imagine what they would all be. I mean, I get that there's a caps lock, a num lock, maybe a like a some kind of, isn't there another one, like a print lock or something? I don't know. I think there's three LEDs up in the corner, and what is they're labeled. What does this say? Win lock. I don't know how to activate that. I don't even know what that is. But anyway, yeah, so there's three LEDs on my keyboard. I mean, there's a bunch of LEDs on my keyboard. I have like a pretty bright lit up keyboard, but I mean, the only one, you know, the three that are little indicators, there's only the three. So I don't know what all those other ones would be, but that's a cool little application. I mean, I don't think I'll ever use it, but I mean, it's fun. It's a fun one. Then there's XKB Bell, which appears to be a way that, you know, is supposed to give feedback, like an audible bell or some kind of alert, I guess, like when you're typing and you type and it's not permitted to type at that point or whatever. I always have that kind of bell turned off anyway in my system settings, so I don't care to try to turn that on for fear of activating a noise that would drive me absolutely batty later on. So I'm not going to do that. I'm not convinced really that would necessarily even function as as sort of advertised. I'm not convinced. I mean, it might, but I mean, how does it know what audio device to use and that sort of thing? I'm not convinced. Okay, anyway, the final XKB utils is the XKB watch, which watches for changes in the, quote, fundamental components of the XKB keyboard state, plus the effective compatibility state. I mean, I have no idea what that means. It doesn't tell me. It doesn't give me any hint of what a fundamental component is. The only option here is version, so I have no idea what this is. I can launch it. It gives me this sort of row of LED lights, or rather an array of LED lights, of you know, graphical LED lights. I guess I could try turning on and off. Yeah, okay. Well, it detected the num lock being turned on and off, and that's really the only thing I can think. What if I press like a volume key? No. Yeah, I don't know what it's looking for exactly. So it must have probably a good function for someone who's like programming stuff, you know, event related things. They probably would know, I guess, what that was doing, but I certainly don't, and it's not giving me any hints. So that's everything, I think, for the XKB packages, such as they are. Next up is, there's one more. I mean, not technically, it's X keyboard config. And that one seems, I don't know, might as well just lump that in with this. This package contains a bunch of definitions around what a keyboard in X11 could possibly contain. And that includes key codes and what they would produce for different vendors. It's got a bunch of different rules and events and symbols and so on. And the idea is that we're really, really deconstructing a keyboard here. We're just defining basically every aspect of a keyboard and how it might behave literally on a per key basis. And that way you could, in theory, modify pretty much any part of that keyboard. I really don't know how important it is that this happens here instead of like some kind of monitoring application. I would think that it's a real bonus for like security, because anything that sits, you know, between you and just the pure functionality of your keyboard within the operating system, who knows what that's then doing, because now it's aware of every keystroke you're making. Whereas this is simply responding to a keystroke at the very initial level of response. So maybe that's the reason this exists in this form. But either way, this feels like really powerful stuff. And I don't know enough about modifying keyboard behavior on other operating systems to know how unique this is, but I certainly have benefited from this kind of control. Like the ability to just overhaul a keyboard and decide that it is going to behave in a different way than how it was designed is super, super, it's a big deal. I have made use of it in lots of different ways, and I absolutely would not trade it for the world. I think it's a brilliant method of just enabling the user to take control of their computing experience, which is that's really, really important. Like that's the power of a computer, is that it doesn't have to be, it's not a mechanical device. There's software, we can tell it what we want it to do. And being able to just modify like this stupid caps key that nobody ever wants anymore, I can make that a control key instead. And that's great. It's so easy to do. And I can make this alt key over here on the right that I've never used for anything, I can make that my compose key. And then I have access to all of these other characters. This is a really big deal. I almost, if anything, I wish there was an even easier way to define this. Like this system, I think, is so powerful. I think I would love to see even further customization, because I think this is a really, really powerful part of Linux. And I know, you know, I mean, anyone can write a software for any other operating system that has exactly that same kind of flexibility, and that's really cool for them, and I'm sure that people do it all the time. But like I say, one, you're now running something between the kernel and the user to just reinterpret key presses, which feels a little bit weird to me. And then two, you know, like in terms of kind of like response and lightweight and stuff like that, I don't know if you really want to have to run a daemon to constantly monitor events like that. I mean, I know that there are daemons monitoring events all the time, but it just seems weird to me. So I really like this in theory, even though I've never directly used this system itself, like the keyboard extension itself. Obviously, I've never modified that myself. I've never gone into these files and messed around with anything, but it's great that they're there. I appreciate what they make possible and wouldn't trade it for the world. That's it. That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening. My name's Klaatu. You can reach me anytime over email with feedback or comments, tips, or just to say hi. My email address is klaatu@slackermedia.info. You can also reach me on the Mastodon network, not Klaatu, at mastodon.xyz. The show's intro and outro music is by Fat Chance Lester. You can find their music on bandcamp.com or on gnuworldorder.info. In the archive, you'll find a music directory containing the album from which this music has been extracted. Until next time, thanks for listening and keep the source open.
Feelings have generally been buried. They lay repressed or suppressed in the back of the mind.